and others I will aid and benefit, for they are living beings like my body. Since I and other beings both in wanting happiness are equal and alike, what difference is there to distinguish us, that I should strive to have my bliss alone? Since I and other beings both in fleeing suffering are equal and alike, what difference is there to distinguish us, that I should save myself and not the others? Since the pain of others does no harm to me, I do not shield myself from it. So why to guard against my future pain, which does no harm to this my present me? To think that I will have to bear it is in fact a false idea, for that which dies is one thing, what is born is something else. It's for the sufferers themselves, you'll say, to shield themselves from injuries that come. The pain felt in my foot is not my hands, so why, in fact, should one protect the other? True, it's inadmissible, you'll say. It happens simply through the force of ego clinging. But what is inadmissible for others and myself should be discarded utterly. Continua and gathering, so-called, like garlands and like armies, are unreal. So there is no one to experience pain, for who is there to be its owner? Suffering has no possessor, therefore no distinctions can be made in it. Since pain is pain, it is to be dispelled. What use is there in drawing boundaries? But why dispel the pains of all? You cannot argue in this way. If my pain is removed, so too should that of others. If theirs is not, then neither should be mine. Compassion makes us feel such pain, you say, so why should we make efforts to engender it? But thinking of the suffering of beings, how can you regard as great the smart of your compassion? And if, through such a single pain, a multitude of sorrows can be cured, such pain as this all loving people strive to foster in themselves and others. Thus Supushpachandra, knowing that the king would cause him harm, did nothing to escape from tribulation, that the pains of many should be ended. Those whose minds are practiced in this way, whose joy it is to soothe another's ills, will venture into hell of unrelenting pain as swans sweep down upon a lotus lake. The ocean-like immensity of joy arising when all beings will be freed, will this not be enough? Will this not satisfy? The wish for my own freedom, what is that to me? The work of bringing benefit to beings will not then make me proud and self-admiring. The happiness of others is itself my satisfaction. I do not expect another recompense. Therefore, just as I defend myself from even slight disparagement, in just the same way with regard to others, I should likewise have a mind protective and compassionate. The drop of sperm and blood belong to others. Yet, through strong habituation, I came to have in its regard a sense of I, though in itself it is devoid of entity. And so, why not identify another's body, calling it my I? And vice versa, why should it be hard to think of this my body as another's? Perceiving now the faults possessed by I, the ocean of good qualities that are in other, I shall lay aside all love of self, and gain the habit of adopting other beings. Just as hands and other limbs are thought of as the members of a body, can we likewise not consider others as the limbs and members of a living whole? Just as in connection with this form, devoid of self, my sense of I arose through strong habituation, why should not the thought of I, through habit, not arise related to another? Thus when I work for others' sake, there'll be no sense of boasting self-congratulation. It is just as when I feed myself, I don't expect to be rewarded. Therefore, just as I defend myself from even slight disparagement, likewise for beings I shall now grow used to have a mind protective and compassionate. This is why the Lord Avalokita, out of great compassion, blessed his name, that those caught in the midst of multitudes might be released and freed from every fear. And so we should be undeterred by hardships, for through the influence of use and habit, people even come to grieve for those whose very names struck terror in their hearts. Those desiring speedily to be a refuge for themselves and others should make the interchange of I and other, and thus embrace the sacred mystery. Because of our attachment to our bodies, even little things alarm us. This body, then, this source of so much terror, who would not detest it as the worst of foes? Wishing to relieve our body's ills, our hungry mouths, the dryness of our throats, we steal the lives of fishes, birds, and deer, and lie in wait along the road. And for the sake of profit and position, some there are who even kill their parents, or steal what has been offered to the triple gem, because of which they'll burn in hell of unrelenting pain. Where are the wise and prudent, then, who cherish, guard, and serve the body? Who would not perceive it as their foe, and as their foe regard it with contempt? If I give this, what will be left for me? Thinking of oneself, the way of evil ghosts. If I keep this, what will be left to give? Concern for others is the way of heaven. If to serve myself I harm another, I'll suffer later in the realms of hell. But if for others' sake I harm myself, then every excellence will be my heritage. Wanting what is best for me, stupidity, inferiority, and lower realms result. Let this be changed, applied to others. Honours and the realms of bliss will come. Enslaving others, forcing them to serve me, I will come to know the state of servitude. But if I labour for the good of others, mastery and leadership will come to me. All the joy the world contains has come through wishing happiness for others. All the misery the world contains has come through wanting pleasure for oneself. Is there need for lengthy explanation? Childish beings look out for themselves. Buddhas labour for the good of others. See the difference that divides them. If I do not interchange my happiness for others' pain, enlightenment will never be attained, and even in samsara joy will fly from me. Leaving future lives outside the reckoning, even this life's needs are not fulfilled. The servants do not do their work, and masters do not pay the wages earned. Casting far away abundant joys that may be gained in this or future lives, because of bringing harm to other beings, I ignorantly bring myself intolerable pain. All the harm with which this world is rife, all fear and suffering that there is, clinging to the eye has caused it. What am I to do with this great demon? If this eye is not relinquished wholly, sorrow likewise cannot be avoided. If they do not keep away from fire, people can't escape from being burned. To free myself from harm and others from their sufferings, let me give myself to others, loving them as I now love myself. For I am now beneath the rule of others, of this you must be certain, O my mind. And now no longer shall you have a thought that does not wish the benefit of beings. My sight and other senses, now the property of others, to use them for myself would be improper, and it is likewise disallowed to use my faculties against their owners. Thus sentient beings will be my chief concern, and everything I see my body has will all be seized and offered for the use and service of all other beings. Take others, lower, higher, equal, as yourself. Identify yourself as other. Then, without another thought, immerse yourself in envy, pride, and rivalry. He's the center of attention, I am nothing. And unlike him, I'm poor without possessions. Everyone looks up to him, despising me. All goes well for him, for me there's only bitterness. All I have is sweat and drudgery, while he's there, sitting at his ease. He's great, respected in the world, while I'm the underdog, a well-known nobody. What? A nobody without distinction? Not true, I do have some good qualities. Compared with some, he's lower down. Compared with some, I do excel. My discipline, my understanding have declined. But I am helpless, ruled by my defilements. As much as he is able, he should cure me. I will be submissive even to his punishments. The fact is, he does nothing of the sort. By what right, then, does he belittle me? What use, then, are his qualities to me, those qualities of which he's so possessed? Indifferent to the plight of living beings who tread the brink of evil destinies, he makes an outward show of virtues and even wants to vie with sages. That I might excel, outstripping him, him regarded as my peer and equal. In contests I will certainly secure my fame and fortune, public renown. By every means I'll advertise my gifts to all the world, ensuring that his qualities remain unknown, ignored by everyone. My faults I will conceal, dissimulate, for I, not he, will be the object of devotion. I, not he, will gain possessions and renown. I will be the center of attention. I will take such satisfaction in his evil deeds and degradation. I will render him despicable, the butt and laughingstock of everyone. People say this pitiful nonentity is trying to compete with me. But how can he be on a par with me in learning, beauty, wealth, or pedigree? Just to hear them talk about my excellence, my reputation on the lips of all. The thrill of it sends shivers down my spine, a pleasure that I bask and revel in. Even if he does have something, I'm the one he's working for. He can keep enough just to survive, but with my strength I'll steal the rest away. I will wear his happiness away. I will always hurt and injure him. He's the one who in Samsara did me mischiefs by the hundred. Countless ages, O my mind, you spent desiring to attain your aims, and what great weariness it was, while your reward was only misery. And therefore now most certainly apply yourself completely to the good of others. The Buddha did not lie in what he said, you'll see the benefits that come from it. If indeed you had in former times embraced this work and undertaken it, you could not still be lacking in the perfect bliss of Buddhahood. Therefore, just as you identify a drop of others' blood and sperm, and cling to it as though it were yourself, now take sentient beings, others, as yourself. Now for others you should spy on everything your body seems to have. Steal it, take it all away, and use it for the benefit of others. I indeed am happy, others sad. I am high and mighty, others low. I am helped while others are abandoned. Why am I not jealous of myself? Happiness, fulfillment, these I give away. The pain of others, this I will embrace. Inquiring of myself repeatedly, I will thus investigate my faults. When others are at fault, I'll take and turn the blame upon myself. And all my sins, however slight, declare and make them known to many. The fame of others I will magnify, that it might thus outshine my own. Among them I will be as one who serves, my lowly labor for their benefit. This ego is by nature rife with faults, its accidental gifts I should not praise. Whatever qualities it has I'll so contrive that they remain unknown to everyone. All the harm, in short, that ego does to its advantage and to others' cost, may all of it descend upon itself, to its own hurt, to others' benefit. Do not let it strut about the place, so arrogant, so overbearing. But like a newly wedded bride, let it be demure and blushing, timorous and shy. Do this, be like that, such things don't ever do. It's thus that you will bring it forcibly to heel. And if it oversteps the mark, well then, apply the lash. And so, O mind, if still you will refuse, though you have been so lengthily advised, since every evil has its roots in you, you are indeed now ripe for punishment. The time when you could do me harm is in the past and now is here no more. Now I see you, where will you escape? I'll bring you down with all your haughty insolence. Let every thought of working for yourself be utterly rejected, cast aside. Now that you've been sold to others, stop your whining, be of service. For if, through being inattentive, I do not deliver you to others, you will hand me over, it is certain, to the guards and janitors of hell. For this is how so many times you have betrayed me, and how long I've suffered. Now my memory is full of rancor, I will crush your selfish schemes. And so it is that if I want contentment, I should never seek to please myself. And likewise, if I wish to guard myself, of others I should always be the guard. To the extent this human form is cosseted and saved from hurt, just so to that degree, it dwindles to a weak and fretful state. For those who sink to such a pass, the earth and all it holds are powerless to satisfy, for who can give them all they crave? Their hopeless craving brings them misery, and evil schemes invade their minds, while those with free, untrammeled hearts will never know an end of excellence. Therefore, for the increase of my body's wants, I'll give no space, no opportunity. And of possessions, those things are the best that do not captivate by their attractiveness. Dust and ashes are the body's final state, this body which, inert, is moved by other forces. This form, so frightening and foul, why do I so regard it as myself? Alive or dead, what difference does it make? What use is this machine to me? What difference will divide it from a clod of earth? Alas, that I don't rid myself of pride. Through lavishing attention on this body, such sorrow I have brought myself so senselessly. What use is all my wanting, all my hating, for what indeed is like a log of wood? Whether I protect and pamper it, or whether it is eaten up by carrion birds, this body feels no pleasure, no aversion. Why then do I cherish it so much? Resentment when it is reviled, or pleasure when it is esteemed? Neither of these two my body feels. So why do I exhaust myself? If I say I do it since it's loved by other people, others whom I thus regard as friends, since all appreciate the bodies that they have, why do I not take pleasure in them too? Therefore, free from all attachment, I will give this body for the benefit of beings. And though it is afflicted by so many faults, I shall adopt it as my necessary tool. And so, enough of all my childish ways. I'll follow in the footsteps of the wise. Recalling their advice on carefulness, I'll shun all sleep and mental dullness. Like the Buddha's heirs in their compassion, I will bear with all that should be borne. For if I do not labor night and day, when will my sorrows reach their end? Thus, to banish all obscuring veils, I'll bend my mind from the mistaken path, and constantly upon the perfect object I shall rest my mind in even meditation. Chapter 9. Wisdom. All these branches of the doctrine the enlightened sage expounded for the sake of wisdom. Therefore they must cultivate this wisdom, who wish to have an end of suffering. Relative and ultimate, these the two truths are declared to be. The ultimate is not within the reach of intellect, for intellect is said to be the relative. In light of this, within the world, two kinds of people are observed: those with yogic insight and the common run of people. In this regard, the views of ordinary folk are undermined by yogis who themselves are in the world, within whose ranks the lower in degrees of insight are confuted by the higher, by means of the examples that the yogis and the worldly both accept. And for the sake of the result, analysis is left aside. When ordinary folk perceive phenomena, they look on them as real and not illusory. This, then, is the subject of debate, where ordinary and yogis differ. Forms and so forth, which we all perceive, exist by general acclaim, but not by valid reasoning. They're false, just like, for instance, unclean things regarded in the common view as pure. But that he might instruct the worldly, our protector spoke of things, but these in truth lack even momentariness. Now if you say it's wrong to claim the momentary as relative, there is no fault, for momentariness is relative for yogis, but for worldly beings ultimate. Were it otherwise, the common view could fault the yogic insight into corporal impurity. Through a Buddha who is but illusion, how does merit spring? As if the Buddha were existing truly. But, you ask, if beings are like illusions, how, when dying, can they take rebirth? As long as the conditions are assembled, illusions likewise will persist and manifest. Why, through simply being more protracted, should sentient beings be regarded as more real? If one kills or harms a magical illusion of a man, there is no mind in such a thing, and therefore there's no sin. But beings do indeed have mirage-like minds. Sin and merit will, in consequence, arise. There is no power in things like spells, so mirage-like minds do not occur through them. Illusions spring from various causes, thus illusions are of different kinds. A single cause for everything there never was. If ultimately beings are in nirvana, you will say, but relatively circle in samsara, even Buddhahood reverts to the samsaric state. So why, you ask, pursue the bodhisattva path? As long as there's no cutting of the causal stream, there is no halting even of illusory displays. But when the causal stream is severed, even relative phenomena do not appear. If even that which is deceived does not exist, what is it, you will ask, that sees illusion? But if for you these same illusions have no being, what indeed is there to be perceived? But objects have another mode of being, you will say. That very mode is but the mind itself. But if the mirage is the mind itself, what is then perceived by what? The guardian of the world himself has said that mind cannot be seen by mind. In just the same way, he has said, the sword's edge cannot cut the sword. But, you say, it's like the flame that perfectly illuminates itself. The flame, in fact, can never light itself. And why? Because the darkness never dims it. The blueness of a thing by nature blue, you say, depends, unlike a crystal, upon nothing else. Likewise, some perceptions come from other things, while some do not. But something that's by nature blue has never of itself imposed a blueness on its non-blue self. The phrase, the lamp illuminates itself, the mind can know and formulate. But what is there to know and say that mind is self-illuminating? The mind indeed is never seen by anything, and therefore whether it can know or cannot know itself is like the beauty of a barren woman's daughter, something that it's pointless to discuss. But if, you ask, the mind is not self-knowing, how does it remember what it knew? We say that like the poison of the water rat, it's through the link with things experienced that memory occurs. In certain cases, you will say, the mind can see the minds of others, how then not itself? But through the application of a magic balm, the eye may see the treasure, but the salve it does not see. It's not indeed our purpose to disprove experiences of sight or sound or knowing. Our aim is here to undermine the cause of sorrow, the thought that such phenomena have true existence. Illusions are not other than the mind, you say. And yet you don't consider them the same. How could they not be different if the mind is real? And how can mind be real if you deny a difference? Although it is unreal, a mirage can be seen, and that which sees is just the same. But samsara must be based on something real, you'll say, or else it is like empty space. But how could the unreal be causally effective, even if it rests on something real? This mind of yours is isolated and alone, alone in solitude and unaccompanied. If the mind indeed is free of objects, all beings must be Buddhas thus gone and enlightened. And so what purpose can there be in saying thus that there is only mind? Even if we know that all is like illusion, how, you ask, will this dispel afflictive passion? Magicians may indeed themselves desire the mirage women they themselves create. The reason is they have not rid themselves of habits of desiring objects of perception. And when they gaze upon such things, their aptitude for emptiness is weak indeed. By training in this aptitude for emptiness, the habit to perceive real things will be relinquished. By training in the thought, there isn't anything, this view itself will also be abandoned. There is nothing. When this is asserted, no thing is there to be examined. How can a nothing, wholly unsupported, rest before the mind as something present? When something and its non-existence both are absent from before the mind, no other option does the latter have. It comes to perfect rest, from concepts free. As the wishing jewel and tree of miracles fulfill and satisfy all hopes and wishes, likewise through their prayers for those who might be trained, the physical appearance of the conquerors occurs. The healing shrine of the Garuda, even when its builder was long dead, continued even ages thence to remedy and soothe all plagues and venom. Likewise, having gained the shrine of victory, in accordance with their deeds for sake of Buddhahood, though bodhisattvas pass beyond all grief, they yet can satisfy all ends. But how, you ask, can offerings made to beings freed from all discursiveness give fruit? It's said that whether Buddhas live or pass beyond, the offerings made to them are equal in their merit. Whether you assert them in the ultimate or relative, merit, so the scriptures say, arises, just as there will be results when Buddhas are considered truly real. We're free, you say, through seeing the four truths. What use is it to us, this view of emptiness? But as the scriptures have themselves proclaimed, without this path there can be no enlightenment. You say the Mahayana has no certainty, but how do you substantiate your own tradition? Because it is accepted by both parties, you will say. But at the outset, you yourself lacked proof. The reasons why you trust in your tradition may likewise be applied to Mahayana. Moreover, if accord between two parties shows the truth, the Vedas and the rest are also true. Mahayana is at fault, you say, because it is contested. But Buddhist texts are questioned by extremists, while Buddhists also vie among themselves. And so your own tradition you should now abandon. The true monk is the root of Dharma, and to be a monk is difficult indeed. It's hard for minds enmeshed in thoughts to pass beyond the bonds of suffering. You say there's liberation in the instant that defilements are entirely forsaken. Yet those who from defilements are set free continue to display the influence of karma. Only for a while, you say, for it is certain that the causes of rebirth, their cravings, are no more. They have no craving granted through defilement, but like their ignorance, why should they not have craving undefiled? This craving is produced by virtue of sensation, and sensation this they surely have. Concepts linger still within their minds, and it is to these concepts that they cling. The mind that has not realized voidness may be halted but will once again arise, just as from a non-perceptual absorption. Therefore one must train in emptiness. If all the words recorded in the sutras you admit to be the Buddha's perfect speech, why don't you now accept the greater part of Mahayana, with which your sutras are in perfect harmony? If due to just a single jarring element, the whole is held to be at fault, why should a single sutra in agreement with your texts not vindicate the rest as Buddha's teaching? Mahakasyapa himself and others could not sound the depths of such a teaching. Who will therefore say that they're to be rejected just because they are not grasped by you? To linger and abide within samsara, freed from every craving and from every fear, in order to achieve the good of those who ignorantly suffer, such is the fruit that emptiness will bear. Therefore it is incorrect to find fault with this view of emptiness. and so, with every doubt abandoned, we should meditate on it. Afflictive passion and the veil upon cognition, the cure for their obscurity is emptiness. How then shall they not meditate on this, who wish for swift attainment of omniscience? Whatever is the source of suffering, let that be the object of our fear. But voidness will allay our every grief. How could it be for us a thing of dread? If such a thing as I exists indeed, then terrors granted will torment it. But since no self or I exists at all, what is there left for fears to terrify? The teeth, the hair, the nails are not the eye, and eye is not the bones or blood. The mucus from the nose and phlegm are not the eye, and neither is it made of lymph or pus. The eye is not the body's grease or sweat. The lungs and liver likewise do not constitute it. Neither are the inner organs eye, nor yet the body's excrement and waste. The flesh and skin are not the eye, and neither are the body's warmth and breath. The cavities within the frame are not the eye, and eye is not accounted for in sixfold consciousness. If the hearing consciousness is permanent, it follows that it's hearing all the time. And if there is no object, what does it cognize? On what grounds do you call it consciousness? If something that's unconscious knows, it follows that a stick has knowledge also. Therefore, in the absence of a thing to know, it's clear that consciousness will not arise. If the self-same consciousness detects a form, at that time why does it not hear? Perhaps, you say, the sound's no longer there. Then neither is there consciousness of sound. How could that which has the nature of a sound perceiver ever be transformed into a form perceiver? A single man, you say, can be both son and father. But these are merely names. His nature is not so. And likewise, pain, neutrality, and pleasure are neither fatherhood nor sonship. And we indeed have never yet observed a consciousness of form perceiving sound. But like an actor, you reply, it takes a different role and sees. If so, this consciousness is not a constant thing. And if its later mode is still the first, that's identity indeed and never seen before. But its different modes, you say, are quite unreal. Its essence, therefore, you must now describe. You say that this is simply knowing. It follows that all beings are a single thing. What has mind and what does not have mind are thus identical, for both are equal in existing. If the different kinds of mind are all unreal, what common basis can there be for them? Something destitute of mind, we hold, is not a self, for mindlessness means matter like a vase. But, you say, the self has consciousness when joined to mind. Then this refutes its nature of unconsciousness. If the self, moreover, is immutable, what change in it could mingling with the mind produce? And selfhood, we might equally affirm, of empty space, inert, and destitute of mind. If self does not exist, you say, there is no link connecting actions with results. If when the deed is done, the doer is no more, who is there to reap the karmic fruit? The bases of the act and fruit are not the same. In both, a self is without scope for action. This is valid both for you and us. What point is there, therefore, in our debate? A cause coterminous with its result is something quite impossible to see, and only in the context of a single mental stream can it be said that one who acts will later reap the fruit. The thoughts now past, and those to come, are not the self. They are no more, or are not yet. Is then the self the thought which now is born? If so, it sinks to nothing when the latter fades. For instance, we may take banana trees, cutting through the fibers, finding nothing. Likewise, analytical investigation will find no I, no underlying self. If beings, you will say, have no existence, who will be the object of compassion? Those whom ignorance imputes, for whose sake we have pledged ourselves. If you ask there are no beings, who will gain the fruit? It's true, it is through ignorance that they are said to be. But for the total vanquishing of sorrow, the goal which ignorance conceives should not be spurned. The source of sorrow is the pride of saying I. It's fostered and increased by false belief in self. To this you may believe that there is no redress, but meditation on no self will be the supreme way. What we call the body is not feet or shins. The body likewise is not thighs or loins. It's not the belly, nor indeed the back, and from the chest and arms the body is not formed. The body is not ribs or hands, armpits, shoulders, bowels or entrails. It is not the head and it is not the throat. What is the body then in all of this? If the body spreads itself and with the members coincides, its parts indeed are present in those parts. But where does body in itself abide? But if the body, single and entire, is present in the hands and other members, however many parts there are, the hands and all the rest, you'll find an equal quantity of bodies. If body is not outside or within its parts, how is it then residing in its members? And since it is not other than its parts, how can you say that it exists at all? Thus there is no body. It is through illusion with regard to hands and other parts that body as a notion is conceived. Just as on account of its specific shape, a pile of stones is taken for a man. As long as the conditions are assembled, the body will appear to be a man. As long as all the parts are likewise present, a body will appear therein. Likewise, since it is a group of fingers, the hand itself does not exist as such. And so it is with fingers made of joints, and joints themselves consist of many parts. These parts themselves will break down into particles, and particles divide according to direction. These fragments, too, like partless parts, they are like space. Thus particles have no existence. All form, therefore, is like a dream, and who will be attached to it who thus investigates? The body in this way has no existence. What, therefore, is male, and what is female? If suffering itself is truly real, why is joy not altogether quenched thereby? If pleasure's real, then why will pleasant tastes not comfort and amuse a man in agony? If the feeling fails to be experienced through being overwhelmed by something stronger, how can feeling rightly be ascribed to that which lacks the character of being felt? Perhaps you say that only subtle pain remains. Its grosser form has now been overmastered. Or rather, it is felt as mere pleasure. But what is subtle still remains itself. If because its opposite is present, discomfort fails to manifest, is not the claim that it's a feeling no more than a mental imputation? Since so it is, the antidote is meditation and analysis. Absorption grown in fields of their investigation is indeed the food and sustenance of yogis. If between the sense power and a thing there is a space, how will the two terms meet? And if there is no space, they form a unity, and therefore what is it that meets with what? No penetration can there be of particle by particle, for they are both the same in lacking volume. But if they do not penetrate, they do not merge. And if they do not merge, there's no encounter. For how could anyone accept that what is partless could be said to meet? And you must show me, if you ever saw, a contact taking place between two partless things. Consciousness is immaterial, and so one cannot speak of contact with it. A combination, too, has no reality, just as we have previously shown. If therefore there's no touch or contact, whence is it that feeling takes its rise? What purpose is there then in all our toil? For what is it, indeed, that torments what? Since there is no subject for sensation, and sensation too lacks all existence, how is craving not arrested when all this is clearly understood? What we see and what we touch is stuff of dreams and mirages. If feeling is coincident with consciousness, it follows that it is not seen thereby. If the one arises first, the other after, memory occurs and not direct sensation. Sensation is without perception of itself, and likewise by another it is not perceived. The agent of sensation has no real existence, thus sensation likewise has no being. What damage, therefore, can sensation do to it, this aggregate deprived of self? The mind within the senses does not dwell. It has no place in outer things like form. And in between, the mind does not abide. Not out, not in, not elsewhere can the mind be found. It is not in the body, yet is nowhere else. It does not merge with it, nor stand apart. Something such as this does not exist, not even slightly. Beings by their nature are beyond the reach of suffering. If consciousness precedes the cognized object, with regard to what does it arise? If consciousness arises at the same time as its object, again, regarding what does it arise? If consciousness comes later than its object, once again, from what does it arise? Thus, the origin of all phenomena exceeds the reach of understanding. If this is so, you say, there is no relative. And then the two truths, what becomes of them? Moreover, if the relative derives from beings' minds, how can they pass beyond their sorrows? But that is just the thought of others. It is not what I mean by the relative. If subsequently there are thoughts, the relative still there. If not, the relative has ceased indeed. The analyzing mind and what is analyzed are linked together, mutually dependent. It is on the basis of conventional consensus that all investigation is expressed. But when, you say, the process of analysis is made in turn the object of our scrutiny, this investigation likewise may be analyzed, and thus we find an infinite regress. If phenomena are truly analyzed, no basis for analysis remains. And when the object is removed, the subject too subsides. That indeed is said to be nirvana. Those who say that both are true are hard-pressed to maintain their case. If consciousness reveals the truth of things, on what grounds, in its turn, does consciousness exist? If knowledge objects show that consciousness exists, what is it that shows that they exist? If both subsist through mutual dependence, both will thereby lose their true existence. If without a son a man cannot be father, whence, indeed, will such a son arise? There is no father in the absence of a son. Just so, the mind and object have no true existence. The plant arises from the seed, you say, and through it is the seed deduced. It's just the same with consciousness arising from its object. How can it fail to show the thing's existence? A consciousness that's different from the plant itself deduces the existence of the seed. But what will show that consciousness exists, whereby the object is itself established? In everyday perception, there's a cause for everything. The different segments of the lotus flower arise from a variety of causes. But what gives rise, you ask, to such variety of causes, an even earlier variety of causes, we declare? And how, you ask, do causes give their fruits? Through power, we answer, of preceding causes. If Ishvara is held to be the cause of beings, you must now define for us his nature. If by this you simply mean the elements, no need to tire ourselves disputing names. Yet earth and other elements are many, impermanent, inert, without divinity. Trampled underfoot, they are impure, and thus they cannot be a god omnipotent. The deity cannot be space, inert and unproductive. He cannot be the self, for this we have refuted. He's inconceivable, they say. Then likewise his creatorship. Is there any point, therefore, to such a claim? What is it that he wishes to create? Has he made the self and all the elements? But are not self and elements and he himself eternal? and consciousness, we know, arises from its object. Pain and pleasure have, from all time, sprung from karma. So tell us, what has his divinity produced? And if there's no beginning in the cause, how can there be beginnings in its fruits? Why are creatures not created constantly? For Ishvara relies on nothing but himself. And if there's nothing that he has not made, what remains on what he might depend? If Ishvara depends, the cause of all is but the meeting of conditions and not Ishvara. When these obtain, he cannot but create. When these are absent, he is powerless to make. If Almighty God does not intend but yet creates, another thing has forced him. If he wishes to create, he swayed by his desire. So even though creator, what of his omnipotence? Those who hold the permanence of particles were indeed refuted earlier. The Samkhyas are the ones who hold that permanent prakriti is the cause of the evolving world. Pleasure, pain, neutrality, so-called, are qualities which, when they rest in equilibrium, are termed prakriti. The universe arises when this balance is disturbed. Three natures in a unity are disallowed, and thus prakriti is without existence. These qualities likewise do not exist, for each of them indeed is three. If these qualities have no existence, a thing like sound is very far from plausible, and cloth and other mindless objects cannot be the seat of feelings such as pleasure. But, you say, these things possess the nature of their cause. But have we not investigated things already? For you the cause is pleasure and the like, and yet from pleasure cloth has never sprung. Pleasure, rather, is produced from cloth. If this is non-existent, pleasure likewise. As for permanence of pleasure and the rest, well, there's a thing that's never been observed. If pleasure and the rest are manifestly present, how comes it that they're not perceived? And if you claim they take on subtle form, how is it that they are both gross and subtle? If coarseness is abandoned, subtlety assumed, subtlety and grossness both lack permanence. So why not grant that in this way all things possess the character of transience? If the coarser aspect is none other than the pleasure, it's clear that pleasure is itself impermanent. If you claim that what does not exist in any sense, because it has no being, cannot manifest, although you have denied the birth of things that did not previously exist, it's this that you're now saying. But if results exist within their cause, those who eat their food consume their excrement. And likewise with the money they would spend on clothing, let them rather buy the cotton grains to wear. But, you say, the world is ignorant and blind, for this is taught by those who know the truth. This knowledge must be present in the worldly too, and if they have it, why do they not see? If now you say that what the worldly see has no validity, this means that what they clearly see is false. If, you ask, there's no validity in valid knowledge, is not all that it assesses false, and therefore it becomes untenable to meditate on voidness, ultimate reality? If there is no object for analysis, there can be no grasping of its non-existence. And so deceptive objects of whatever kind will also have a non-existence equally deceptive. When therefore in one's dream a child has died, the state of mind that thinks it is no more supplants the thought that it is living still. And yet both thoughts are equally deceptive. Therefore, as we see through such investigation, nothing is that does not have a cause, and nothing is existent in its causes, taken one by one or in the aggregate. It does not come from somewhere else, neither does it stay nor yet depart. How will what confusion takes for truth in any sense be different from a mirage? Things then bodied forth by magic spells, and that which is displayed by dint of causes, whence have these arisen, we should ask? And where they go to, that we should examine. What is seen when circumstances meet, and is not seen in absence of the same, is not real, it is like an image in a mirror. How can true existence be ascribed to it? What need is there for cause in something that's already real? But then, what need is there for cause in something that does not exist? Even through 100 million causes, no change takes place in non-existent things. For in that state of non-thing, how could things occur? And into what could non-existent things transform? Since things cannot become when they are non-existent, when could such existent things occur? For insofar as entities do not arise, non-entities themselves will not depart. And if non-entity is not dispersed, no chance is there for entity to manifest. And entity cannot be changed into non-entity, for otherwise it has a double nature. Thus there are no entities, and likewise there's no ceasing of the same. And therefore beings, each and every one, are without origin and never cease. Wandering beings thus resemble dreams, and also the banana tree. In ultimate reality there's no distinguishing between the states of sorrow and beyond all sorrow. With things that in this way are empty, what is there to gain and what to lose? Who is there to pay me court and honours, and who is there to scorn and to revile me? Pleasure, sorrow, whence do these arise? What is there to give me joy and pain? And if I search their very suchness, who is craving? What is craved? Examine now this world of living beings. Who is there therein to pass away? What is there to come, and what has been? And who indeed are relatives and friends? May beings like myself discern and grasp that all things have the character of space. But those who seek their happiness and ease through disputes or enjoyments, all are deeply troubled or else thrilled with joy. They suffer, strive, contend among themselves, slashing, stabbing, injuring each other. They live their lives engulfed in evil and travail. From time to time they surface in the states of bliss, abandoning themselves to many pleasures. But dying down they fall to suffer torment, long unbearable in realms of sorrow. Many are the chasms and abysses of existence, where the truth of suchness is not found. All is contradiction, all denial. Suchness in this world is not like this. Here, exceeding all description, is the shoreless sea of pain unbearable. Here it is that strength is low, and lives are flickering and brief. All activities for sake of life and health, relief of hunger and of weariness, time consumed in sleep, all accident and injury, and sterile friendships with the childish. Thus life passes quickly, meaningless. True discernment hard it is to have. How therefore shall we ever find the means to curb the futile wanderings of the mind? Further, evil forces work and strain to cast us down into the states of woe. Manifold are false, deceptive trails, and it is hard to dissipate our doubts. Hard it is to find this state of freedom, harder yet to come upon enlightened teachers. Hard indeed to turn aside the torrent of defilement. Alas, our sorrows fall in endless streams. Alas indeed that living beings carried on the flood of bitter pain, however terrible their plight may be, do not perceive they suffer so. They are like those who bathe themselves repeatedly, and then proceed to scorch themselves with fire. They suffer greatly in this way, yet there they stay, proclaiming loud their bliss. Likewise there are some who live and act as though old age and death will never come to them. But first they're slain, and then there comes the dreadful fall into the states of loss. When shall I be able to allay and quench the dreadful heat of suffering's blazing fires, with plenteous rains of my own bliss that pour torrential from my clouds of merit? My wealth of merit gathered in, with reverence but without conceptual target, when shall I reveal this truth of emptiness to those who go to ruin through belief in real existence? Chapter 10, Dedication. By all the virtue I have now amassed, by composition of this book which speaks of entry to the Bodhisattva way, may every being tread the path to Buddhahood. May beings everywhere who suffer torment in their minds and bodies have, by virtue of my merit, joy and happiness in boundless measure. As long as they may linger in samsara, may their joy be undiminished. May they taste of unsurpassed beatitude, in constant and unbroken continuity. Throughout the spheres and reaches of the world, in hellish states as many as there are, may beings who abide there taste the bliss and peace of Sukhavati. May those caught in the freezing ice be warmed, and from great clouds of bodhisattvas torrents rain in boundless streams to cool those burning in infernal fires. May forests where the leaves and blades are swords become sweet groves and pleasant woodland glades. And may the trees of miracles appear supplanting those upon the hill of Shalmali. And may the very pits of hell be sweet with fragrant pools all perfumed with the scent of lotuses, and lovely with the cries of swan and goose and waterfowl so pleasing to the ear. May fiery coals turn into heaps of jewels, the burning ground become an even crystal floor. May crushing hills become sublime abodes, offering temples, dwellings of the Buddhas. May the hail of weapons, lava, fiery stones, become henceforth a rain of flowers, and all the mutual woundings with sharp blades be now a rain of flowers thrown in play. And those engulfed in fiery Vaitarani, their flesh destroyed, their bones bleached white as kunda flowers, may they, through all my merit strength, have godlike forms, and sport with goddesses in Mandakini's peaceful streams. What fear is it, they'll ask, that grips the henchmen of the deadly lord, the frightful vultures and the carrion crows? What noble strength is it that brings us joy and drives away our dreadful night? And looking skyward they will see the shining form of Vajrapani. Then may their sins be quenched in joy, and may they go to him. And when they see the seething lava flood of hell extinguished in a rain of blossoms, drenched in fragrant streams, at once fulfilled in bliss they'll ask, how can this be? May then the denizens of hell behold the one who holds the lotus. Friends, throw away your fears and quickly gather here, for who is it who comes to us to banish dread, this gleaming youth with bound-up hair, this loving bodhisattva saving and protecting every being, whose power relieves all pain, bestowing joy? Behold the 100 gods who lay their crowns before his lotus feet, the rain of flowers that falls upon his head, his eyes moist with compassion, the splendor of his house that echoes praises of 1,000 goddesses. May those in hell thus cry on seeing Manjugosha. And likewise, through my roots of virtue, seeing bodhisattvas like Samantabhadra free from stain, those clouds of bliss all laden with a cooling scented rain, may all those languishing in hell come now to perfect joy. And may the stooping animals be freed from fear of being preyed upon, each other's food. And may the famished spirits have such joy as those who dwell within the northern continent. And may they be replete and satisfied by streams of milk that flow from noble Lord Avalokita's hand, and bathing in it may they be refreshed and cooled. And may the blind receive their sight, and may the deaf begin to hear, and women near their time bring forth like Maya Devi free from all travail. And may the naked now be clothed, and all the hungry eat their fill, and may those parched with thirst receive pure waters and delicious drink. May the poor and destitute find wealth, the haggard and the careworn joy. May those now in despair be whole in mind, endowed with sterling constancy. May every being ailing with disease be freed at once from every malady. May every sickness that afflicts the living be wholly and forever absent from the world. May those who go in dread have no more fear. May captives be unchained and now set free. And may the weak receive their strength. May living beings help each other in kindness. May travelers upon the road find happiness no matter where they go. and may they gain without the need of toil the goals on which they set their hearts. May those who put to sea in